It is Friday, October the 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Pakistan rescues a Western couple, and President Trump praises the action.
The Pakistani government's cooperation is a sign that it is honoring America's wish that it do more to provide security in the region.
Human Rights Watch, Turkey and torture. Also, President Trump and the news media, plus some jazz guitar. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Pakistan's military has rescued a U.S.-Canadian family from a tribal region bordering Afghanistan nearly 5 years after they were abducted by militants. My colleague Sarah Williams speaks with correspondent Ayaz Gul in Islamabad about the Pakistan military action.
They rescued the couple and their three children from this Kuram tribal district, which borders Afghanistan, and that has been a known militant hideout for years. And that's where, according to officials, these hostages were being shifted from Afghanistan on October the 11th. And that is when the Pakistani military says it received intelligence tip from the United States, from U.S. officials, and they conducted the operation and rescued Caitlin Coleman and Joshua Boyle and their three kids who were actually born while the couple was in captivity.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. But now apparently the family has already left for the United States?
Well, that's what we know from the military officials here, that they left Pakistan today to their country of origin. They did not say exactly to which country, but we understand that since Boyle is a Canadian national and Coleman, she's an American citizen, so it's not clear to which destination they have been sent back, but they have left Pakistan, and finally it brings an end to this ordeal that they were going through, like they were kidnapped somewhere in Afghanistan while they were there as tourists. And they were kidnapped, and later in 2012, and later the Taliban insurgency claimed that they were actually responsible for the kidnapping. And they released two video of these hostages last year. In fact, one in 2013 and the second one in 2016. And in both the video messages, Coleman actually begged the U.S. authorities to negotiate with the Taliban so that they can be safely released and they could go back to their home. And let me just tell you that Taliban, during all these years, were demanding release of some of their prisoners who are being held either in Afghan prisons or in Bagram, which is being controlled. This is the air base, the largest air base the U.S. Is running in Afghanistan. So the Taliban wanted some of their prisoners to be released in exchange for these hostages, but it now clearly is evident that if Pakistan Army has rescued and there was a joint operation, that, you know, these people have been safely released without meeting any demands of the militants. And also, we know for sure, as per the information the U.S. military and U.S. officials have been providing, that it was the Haqqani network, the terrorist organization that is part of the Taliban, who captured these Westerners, and they were holding them. And this is the network, you know, that has been causing, you know, is a major irritant between the U.S. and Pakistan in terms of their bilateral relations, because U.S. officials and even Afghan leaders believe leaders of the Haqqani network are based on the Pakistani side of the border and conducting militant activities in Afghanistan against the U.S.-led forces and Afghan security forces.
Ayaz Gul in Islamabad speaking with VOA's Sarah Williams. Here in Washington, President Trump praised the release of the family from the Haqqani network.
The Pakistani government's cooperation is a sign that it is honoring America's wish that it do more to provide security in the region. And I want to thank the Pakistani government. I want to thank Pakistan. They worked very hard on this, and I believe they're starting to respect the United States again. It's very important. I think a lot of countries are starting to respect the United States of America once again. We hope to see this type of cooperation and teamwork in helping secure the release of remaining hostages and in our future joint counterterrorism operations.
The Haqqani Network was founded by Jalaluddin Haqqani, a one-time ally of the United States who achieved fame fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 1980s and who developed close ties to the slain al-Qaeda chief Osama bin Laden. After Jalaluddin's death, his son Sirajuddin Haqqani took over. Elder Haqqani aligned his group with the Taliban after the insurgents were driven from power in the U.S.-led invasion that followed the 2001 U.S. terror attacks. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S.-based Human Rights Watch has published a report on Turkey claiming torture and abductions are being used against people accused of terrorism or being behind last year's failed coup. We get the story now from Dorian Jones in Istanbul.
The Human Rights Watch report said its investigation revealed people in Turkey accused of links to terrorism or with last year's coup attempt have been tortured while in police custody, while others have been abducted by unknown assailants and subsequently abused. Benjamin Ward of Human Rights Watch says the investigation of 11 cases reveals an alarming trend.
We've got a pattern of people being subject to horrible abuse, severe beatings, people being stripped naked, in some cases people being sexually assaulted or threatened with sexual assault, very serious ill treatment indeed.
The report says all cases investigated were related to the Turkish state's war against the Kurdish insurgency or people linked to last year's failed coup, in which over 240 people were killed. Along with torture, the report highlighted the spectre of illegal abductions. It cited one case of a person taken by masked men in the capital, Ankara, and abused for 2 months before being handed over to the police. Human Rights Watch's Ward said the HRW investigation also uncovered a climate of intimidation, preventing those abused from seeking redress.
Their lawyers, in some cases, being threatened if they try to shed light on this abuse, and also, in some cases, medical personnel being intimidated or pressured not to reveal or to document injuries that would evidence that abuse. There have been a handful of investigations which don't seem to be going anywhere, but in most cases, no investigations at all.
Ankara strongly denies the use of torture. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's AK party, on coming to power in 2002, declared a policy of zero tolerance for torture. Ward acknowledges progress had been made in the past.
Turkey has taken some positive steps over the last decade to try to deal with its torture problem, and that had made a difference. So this isn't a case of just, you know, business as usual. This is a situation where things have got better and now they're getting worse. And so I think it is imperative for Turkey's international partners to really raise this issue.
The Human Rights Watch report called on the Turkish government to investigate its claims and recommit itself to its promise to end torture. The rights group said its request for the government to contribute to its investigation went unanswered. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
President Trump has suggested challenging licenses for NBC and other U.S. broadcast news networks, a salvo that followed reports his own Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, had called him a moron after a discussion of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. NBC was the first news network to report the alleged comment by the Secretary of State. Mr. Trump and his supporters have repeatedly used the term fake news to cast doubt on critical media reports about his administration, often without providing any evidence to support their case that the reports were untrue. The president kept up his criticism of the media in an appearance with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau this week.
It's frankly disgusting the way the press is able to write whatever they want to write, and people should look into it.
Any move to challenge media company licenses, however, would likely face significant hurdles. The Federal Communications Commission, an independent federal agency, does not license broadcast networks but issues them to individual broadcast stations that are reviewed on a staggered basis of 8-year periods. For more on all of this, VOA's Lori London talks to Katie Culver. She is director for the Center for Journalism Ethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
First and foremost, I was astounded that a U.S. political figure of any level, but notably the President of the United States, would so fundamentally misunderstand the Constitution and the idea that our news media are licensed in some way. We call it the first freedom for a reason. I mean, part of what we were escaping was an imperial licensing scheme, trying to shut down the press by forcing them to be licensed and taxed. That's part of what the founders were specifically designing that document, which still lives and breathes to this day, to avoid. So I was absolutely astounded at that assertion. I think it's dangerous in that it misinforms his supporters, that that's something that is not only possible but desirable. I also think it's interesting that we have yet to have a person associated with that NBC story, other than Trump, dispute its veracity. It's not as though anyone who was in that meeting is arguing that what NBC reported through sources as happening didn't happen. So it's not just an attempt to silence news media, it's an attempt to silence them for what may well be a completely accurate report that is in context.
Well, since he's gotten pushback from that, he's made other statements saying things like the press really shouldn't be able to say whatever it wants.
And the press can't say whatever it wants. There are systems in the United States whereby if we get things wrong, we are liable for those things. And we are also liable for invasions of privacy, for acts that can incite violence. I mean, the First Amendment is not absolute. There are ways to pursue actions against news media. Now, he did as a candidate and has not really said as much as president, but he did as a candidate express a desire to dramatically change, for instance, the way libel cases play out in the United States. Again, that statement being something of a tacit threat, that if you come after me, I'm going to make it easier to sue you. And those are, you know, when you're looking at news media in the financial state that they're in right now in the U.S., those are very real threats. So we saw an entire site, Gawker, taken down by an invasion of privacy suit, a huge judgment against them. Those are real things. You know, if Harvey Weinstein threatens a libel case against the New York Times, that's a difficult thing for the New York Times to defend itself against. So just saying I'm going to upend those laws, it's reasonable to interpret that as a threat against news media.
Right. Since he declared his candidacy, he has pretty much been waging war, as you said, with what he calls the fake news media, which seems to be any media outlet that doesn't speak favorably of him.
Correct.
Certain outlets, in fact, were blocked during presidential rallies and campaign rallies. His staffers literally have blocked some reporters from attending briefings. How does that fit into what is allowed? Do they have the right to do that?
So let me just say that I, during the Obama administration, was concerned about some actions that administration took to work around news media, to limit access and those sorts of things. You know, if I would have called those concerns now, I can't even imagine what I would call the situation that we're in now. This is an administration that has shown a hostility toward the news media that I have never seen before in my life. I suppose you could go back to the Hamilton and Jefferson days to see some very, partisan and vicious bickering in the press. But we now have a situation where we are misrepresenting the Constitution as somehow allowing a system of licensing, attacking news media for what appear to be accurate and contextual reports, and denying access for news media to do reporting. I will confess I was a little worried at the beginning of this administration that news media would sort of back off and be kowtowing to the administration, but I see no evidence of that. There's been tremendous courage and bravery going on with the reporting that they've been doing, so they don't appear to be deterred. That's not to say that news media are always right. We are human, and we make human errors, but in the main, they do try to get it right, and they do try to live up to that fundamental principle that you cannot have a democracy without a free press. You simply cannot have it.
The president has been known to say things that were blatantly false. That's been proven by many fact checkers. So would you say there's somewhat of an irony here?
Oh, absolutely. I would say there absolutely is an irony in a person who seems to peddle falsehood, claiming that another institution that tries to report the truth doesn't always get it right, but tries. To accuse them of being fake news is a real stunner.
Katie Culver is director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. Now it's time to see what's happening in the world of social media. Here's VOA's Andrew Palchevsky.
For months, we've been talking about Russia's interference on social media in the United States, particularly surrounding the U.S. presidential election. And today, that is still a topic of conversation. Because this week, Facebook Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg came to Capitol Hill to meet with key congressional leaders about Facebook ads that were purchased by Russian-affiliated groups. Facebook had already announced that there were about 3,000 ads that were purchased in the lead-up to the U.S. presidential election to try to influence opinion on particular issues. Well, now, Sheryl Sandberg, representing Facebook, is speaking out about what is in these ads, how far they went, how much money was put behind them, and how much influence they may have had. Now, right now, these conversations are occurring behind closed doors on Capitol Hill. But according to congressional leaders, we will get a glimpse at these ads sometime soon. They say that after the meetings with Sandberg and after Facebook, Twitter, and Google come to Capitol Hill on November 1st to testify about the Russian misinformation efforts, they will release the content of those ads. So we will get a look at these in the coming weeks, and we will finally get to see what misinformation was being spread. Now, Sandberg wasn't just on Capitol Hill making headlines. She was also talking to the news agency Axios about the Russian misinformation on Facebook. She said that Facebook doesn't just owe Americans an apology for the misinformation and the role that the social network played, but determination that this will not happen again and Facebook will work to correct and resolve the issues that allowed these ads to be purchased in the first place. She said that things happened on the platform that should not have happened, but guaranteed that in the future, they will not happen again. But it's not just misinformation that's a problem on social media. It's also money, particularly fraud. Because according to a new report, fraud cases on social media in 2016 have reached an all-time high, more than 437,000 cases where people have been duped out of money on Twitter, Facebook, and other social networks. Now, according to that research from company ZeroFOX, that fraud could account for up to $180 million in global losses. On a more micro level, they say that the average victim loses about $414 on these different scams that ask for bank account numbers, credit card information, or promise people millions of dollars if only they'll wire a bank transfer fee. Of course, there are no millions of dollars, and that bank transfer fee gets pocketed by the criminals who are duping these people. It's a good reminder that oftentimes on social media, you'll see these offers and promises of money that sound just too good to be true. And guess what? They are.
Indeed. VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. Thanks a bunch, Andrew. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
In the backyard of Beat Spotsel is an old shipping container, but inside, an entire ready-to-go beer production line. It's called the Smart Brewery Container. Pavel Pozovol is the manufacturer and says the whole world is already flooded with mainstream large industrial brewers. He says we wanted to go against this, not home-brewed beer, but with beer people can brew themselves, which is unfiltered, unpasteurized, fresh beer. The containers can be delivered anywhere in the world. They're easy to operate and cost about $100,000 and includes a 5-week training program by a brewmaster and all the ingredients to get you started. And that's why Vít Spatzl and his brother bought one. He says this is the easiest and most affordable solution that people can get. The smart brewery can produce 525 hectoliters of beer each year in a country that already makes some 20 million hectoliters of beer annually. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. In today's report from the music department, we're going to jazz it up a bit. After many years as band leader of the late-night U.S. TV program, The Tonight Show, guitarist Kevin Eubanks left the show in 2010. Now he's gotten his jazz groove back, pairing up with guitarist Stanley Jordan for a new album, Duets. Nature Boy is the third cut on the album, which includes original compositions and lots of old favorites, as well as new hits. On the recording label Mac Avenue, Eubanks and Jordan got together to talk about their collaboration.
We've been kind of on the same record labels and same festivals like throughout our careers, so it was about time that we looked it up, and we were trying to go over. What are some of the other names you have for the record?
Black and Blacker.
Black and Blacker. That's like a Chris Rock movie or something. I don't know.
And actually, I think Kevin was really busy, and I was trying to get his attention, you know, because I was getting pressure from the label, like, you guys need a title. So I thought, okay, how can I get his attention? So I sent him an email, like an official-looking email that said, you know, if you don't respond within 48 hours, the title of the record will be Black and Blacker. And he got back to me within like an hour and said, no.
On Duets, Eubanks and Jordan's intimate, relaxed style is evident in the more spontaneous, rather than overproduced, mixing of some jazz standards, as well as contemporary pop tunes and original compositions. Sun is one of two original songs on Duets. Other cuts on Duets include Thad Jones' ballad, A Child Is Born, Miles Davis's Blue and Green, George Gershwin's Summertime, and a moving interpretation of Adele's hit, Someone Like You. Thank you. Though Duets is the first recording together for Kevin Eubanks and Stanley Jordan, they've been friends since the early 1980s, always displaying some special chemistry. Really nice album. Downloaded it, have it on my phone, listen to it all the time. You'd love it too. A couple of other stories for you. Nominees for this year's American Music Awards. Well, they're out. Bruno Mars, the top nominee with 8 nods, while the Chainsmokers, Drake, Kendrick Lamar, Ed Sheeran, and The Weeknd all got 5 nominations apiece. Justin Bieber, Danny Yankee, and Luis Fonsi. Well, of course, they got some nominations because they are nominated for the favorite pop rock song at collaboration known as Despacito. Keith Urban getting the biggest nods for the country artist, 3 nominations for him. Alessia Cara, Lady Gaga, and Rihanna all nominated for favorite female artist in the pop rock format. Rock star Bruce Springsteen, well, guess what? He's up to something new. It is called Springsteen on Broadway. It opened on Thursday night. It is his life story with a soundtrack, a one-man show that is both funny and touching. It's a different show every night. Springsteen on stage 5 nights a week through February the 3rd, and is what is being called his Broadway debut, even though he's sung there before. Listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, and we're hoping you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is in mourning after the horrific shooting that took place at an outdoor music concert in Las Vegas October 1st that claimed the lives of 58 people and wounded hundreds more. The shooter was found dead from apparently self-inflicted wounds in the hotel room where he carried out the attack. Investigators have not yet attributed a motive for the largest mass shooting in modern American history, but the FBI has said no evidence of terrorism has emerged so far. President Donald Trump flew to Las Vegas to meet with victims of the massacre and speak to first responders, law enforcement officials, and civilians who came to the aid of their countrymen during the attack. There are many such people in the latter category, men like Jonathan Smith, who is credited with saving the lives of at least 30 people until he was felled by 2 bullets and dragged to safety by off-duty policeman Tom McGrath, or cab driver John Zerquera Jimenez, who repeatedly drove into danger to transport people away from the carnage. In his remarks to law enforcement officials, President Trump asked God to bless the men and women who protect us and bring healing to the families of the wounded, the injured, and the fallen. He also said, "In the depths of horror, we will always find hope in the men and women who risk their lives for ours."
We cannot be defined by the evil that threatens us or the violence that incites such terror. We're defined by our love, our caring, and our courage. In the darkest moments, what shines most brightly is the goodness that thrives in the hearts of our people.
"We are blessed to be surrounded with heroes," President Trump said.
As one eyewitness recounted this week, while everyone else was crouching, police officers were standing up as targets, just trying to direct people and tell them where to go. Parents and spouses used their own bodies as shields to protect their loved ones. Americans dashed into a hail of bullets to rescue total strangers.
"In the months ahead," President Trump said, "we will all have to struggle with the horror of what has unfolded, but we will struggle through it together. We will endure the pain together, and we will overcome together as Americans."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.